And now, from beyond our dimension, this is the Jeff Mara Podcast. Here's Jeff.
My guest is Andy Sharp, writer and multimedia artist who has an MSc in neuroscience from King's College. Today we'll be discussing his second book, The Astral Geographic, which is an occult travel guide featuring 10 mystical tours through history and around the globe. Andy, thank you for joining me and welcome.
Pleasure. Thanks, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
So, Andy, when you wrote this book, did you travel to all these sites?
Not all destinations, no. I mean, I'd say half of them, but part of the idea of the book is that whilst they are tangible, it's obviously a wide-ranging topic, and my idea was to create a visual experience of traveling and also a kind of strong narrative. So I would say it's the conceit of a travel guide to tell a story. So whilst I've visited a fair amount of places, some of them are descriptions of places and historical descriptions, but it's intended to be very visual, but it's also been, as I said, intended to be an astral guide, so it's one you can follow from your armchair, whereas, you know, a typical sort of travel guide, it just kind of tells you the bones about a place, and you know, they tend to be unconnected dots on a map, whereas each of the itineraries are kind of narrative journeys. So it's a travel, writing really, but within the kind of conceit of a travel guide, but also the history of magic through geography. So yeah, so the intention is to create a story really.
Would you say that you're a secret occultist? And if not, what inspired you to write this book?
No, I'm not a secret. I've always practiced magic. So in actual fact, the last chapter in the book is called the Grimoire and Terror, which is a simple, short introduction to practical magic using geography as an important ingredient. And now this is not something that's kind of just something I devised ad hoc. Actually, noticed in kind of Neoplatonic magic that whilst it's not described in planetary magic sort of correspondence table, there's a strong geographic element in it. If you read people like Agrippa, they explain the properties of certain places. Like if you want to do magic for love or something like that, they recommend going to certain places, gardens and things like that. And a martial ritual that they suggest going to places where there have been sacrifices or, you know, sort of executions and things like that. So what I did in the last part of the book was to create a simple set of rituals using harnessing this kind of history of place really. And I've also devised a set of sort of virtual cards to enable you to practice astral travel or whatever you want to call it, Jungian active imagination, things like that. Now they're all things that are used in a creative capacity really. I mean, most of my interest for magic is a facilitator in the creative process, I have to say. You know, in the past I've done practical magic for kind of mundane, what you term mundane, but my preference is to enhance the creative process really. I tested out these simple rituals that I devised in the book, and I was quite surprised by their efficacy really.
That's interesting. I've never heard of that before, to use magic to enhance your creative processes.
Yeah, I think there's a long tradition of that. If you look at writers like William Burroughs, whose big influence on me is his book Cities of Red Night, uses a ritual from an Arabian book of magic called Picatrix to induce lucid dreaming. And so that's actually one of the things I explore in the book, this particular ritual. So there is a strong tradition of it. Artists like Austin Spare, their creative process was intimately tied in with their magic. Occultists like Kenneth Grant, who devised creative systems of magic for borrowing from Pulp Fiction, Lovecraft, and things like that. So, yeah, this is, again, it's not something I've come off the top of my head. It's something that there is a kind of a tradition, really, in modern magic, really. I think if you look at the term magic and imagination, there's the same etymology, really. So that's where I come from, really. And I kind of see the imagination as something kind of quite supernatural in itself. You know, it's got supernatural powers, really.
Well, there's both white and black magic. So I presume you dabble in the white arts, right?
Oh, yeah, I would never. I mean, I write about black magic, but I would never, ever do anything that was considered deleterious to people. And I'm very, as I said, whilst I've given examples for it, I'm quite cautious about any form of operation that involves trying to manipulate the destiny of someone else. You see what I mean? So if you think about something like a magical potion for love or something like that, whilst I think they work, I tend to stay clear of that, because it feels like you're dabbling with someone else's destiny, whereas I'm really interested in your own destiny. I think, for want of a better word, there's better karma through it being an internal process of one of driving things. And I've also got slight issues with materialism as well, treasure seeking stuff, things to get money and basically get the universe to do bidding for you for materialistic gains. Again, I think it's all about nourishing the soul, really, rather than, for me, it is, but these rituals will work if you want to do those things. And I'm happy to allow people to do that, because I don't really want to make judgments about other. I've got quite a non-judgmental view of life, really, and other people. So whilst it's not for me, I haven't really got a problem with other people doing it. It's up to them.
In the US, if someone refers to themselves as a magician, they're generally looked at as somebody who pulls rabbits out of hats and performs on stage. Whereas practicing magic, they would probably be considered a warlock or something.
Yeah.
What would you classify yourself as?
I would call myself an occultist, really. I like the term magician, to be honest. But yeah, there is this. I don't know where the two. To be honest, I don't know where the. The concept of the stage conjurer and the kind of esoteric conjurer became like fought, really. But I do like the term magic. I love the term magic. I actually prefer the term magic to occultism. But yeah, there is the confusion, isn't it? And also, I'm slightly dubious about calling yourself a magic, because a magician, it almost implies a level of superiority. Do you see what I mean? Because you're a magician, you might not be a very good magician, but the kind of term is quite, it's got a kind of loftiness that I wouldn't apply to myself. But I love the concept. I love the idea of magic. So I would just say an occultist.
What kind of successes have you had personally with magic?
Career, various other romantic things in the past. But yeah, as I said, it's not really something that I mean, when I was younger, of course you do that. There's the two things you do that's the first things you try out when you're interested in magic, or pleasures of materiality, because it seems to open up. And I think that's, I think that's a healthy, I think it's, the only way you can really explore magic is by kind of from a sort of material basis, because you start to realize that it's one thing getting what you want, it's the other thing, you know, dealing with getting what you want. And this brings it up in kind of more kind of bigger ideas, you know, about the concept of desire and the concept of achieving your desire and things like that. And if you're a kind of quite reflective person at some stage, quite early on in the process of magic, you start to question and desire itself. And that's pretty much, well, whether it's for money, whether it's for love, whether it's for anything, you start to question that if you're reflective, and start to realize, well, it's a bigger, you know, there's a part of me that is searching for something that is the notion of desire, if you like, the notion of desire. And I think that's where creativity comes into it. And that's where, you know, I felt, it feels like a more self-generative process when you use magic and creativity. As he said, you're not getting the universe to do your bidding in order to get something that's outside your material gain, which essentially is like material magic, low magic, they call it. Whereas you're nurturing your soul, when it's an internal kind of process, more similar to alchemy or you know, if you look at it from a therapeutic view, like depth psychology or something like that. And that's more my interest. It's more self-nourishing approach.
Doing magic for money, relationships, or success, to me sounds almost like what we talk about here a lot, and that is manifesting. You know, people want to manifest stuff either through meditation, affirmations, or positive thinking to manifest the same sort of things, you know, money, relationships, success in your life. I feel, and maybe you can correct me on this, that doing a ritual to do that is almost kind of like a meditative act.
It is. I was thinking about this. What if you think about something you want to do in life, you can, and if you think about things like the butterfly effect, that every action has an effect in somewhere in reality, you know, kind of this idea that, and it does, you know, if you move to the left on a road, if you move down the road, your whole destiny's, you know, if you miss that bus and get on the next bus, who knows what the difference would have been in your destiny. But where ritual comes in is you're still doing an action, but you're consciously making a decision to shift your reality, the destiny of your reality by that action. So it's more than meditation. It's an action, you know, you're putting, you know, if you think about the analogy with missing a bus and getting the next one, is, you know, that first bus could crash, or that first bus you might meet someone who changes your life. Do you see what I mean? So but the actual act of like a ritual is like you're going out of reality and you're going, right, I'm going to do these actions here in this kind of like experimental chamber and stuff like that will affect the my reality. So when you think about it with that same analogy, that not doing it would have affected your reality just as much as doing it, but when you're doing it, it's going to have more of a ripple. But it's interesting you're talking about manifest. The same thing happens, the same sense of manifest happens in the creative thing. So weird things start happening when you start to mix fiction and writing and music or whatever, and art, the you know, visual arts with magic, is that things, if you're writing a piece of fiction, things in your reality start to manifest in the fiction, and bits of fiction you write manifest in reality and things like that. So when you're, that's certainly what I've experienced with using it in a creative sense, is that actually the creative output then creates synchronicity with reality. And that's where it's really interesting. And things get very strange, stranger, than magic working is magic doing something different. It's all about transformation. Your magic is change. It's about change, really. So you're changing reality.
Can you share with my audience one simple magic ritual to increase either success or money or find a relationship partner?
Okay, so the one I mentioned in the book is actually is a lunar ritual, and this is, again, it's an internal process. It's to master the art. So lunar ritual is like mastery of the art of astral travel.
All right.
There's certain rituals you can do that you can say, I want to learn this skill. And the one I give in the book is because the book has got a bunch of exercises in astral travel. I thought, well, the ritual I should demonstrate in the book is to increase my ability to master astral travel. And this one involves, so the one I give in the book involves going to a river. And there's a concept called gnosis in magic, which is the point of a ritual where you lose self-control. So, traditionally people would take drugs or sex or whatever to have that. But in this one, I'm looking at the idea of immersing yourself in very cold water to experience a kind of liberation of your ego, if you like. So in this example, I'm using geography, landscape as a deliberate means to get in a different state of mind at the climax of the ritual. So the ritual involves making a talisman that's got a lunar symbol on it, and holding that in your hand and then jumping into water at the ritual to charge the kind of talisman, charge the operation. And that's a very simple case. So there's other ways I'm using magic in the book, for instance, or suggesting, you might want to climb a mountain or go on an exercise, run through a park and things like that, or go to the gym, see, and exercise in the gym. You would do that for a Jupiterian ritual, because the Neoplatonic correspondence suggested that if you wanted to do a rite of Jupiter, then you go to an exercise yard. So I think, if you run on a treadmill, exhaust yourself on a treadmill while visualizing a symbol of what you want to, what of your desire, that'll have the same process. So meditation does come into it, but it's a kind of charge meditation.
So you're saying that if you create some sort of symbol of the moon, hold it in your hand and jump into cold water, that will cause you to have an out-of-body experience?
Well, this concept particularly comes from the idea that in order for magic to manifest, it's got to embed itself in your subconscious. It's got to circumvent the conscious mechanism. So, as I said, people try and achieve this form of gnosis in lots of different ways, through like ecstatic dancing, for instance, in voodoo, drug taking, it's not just one, sex magic, Crowley, people like that. But what I'm saying here is that you can achieve this kind of embodied state, or where the conscious mind is circumvented by immersing yourself in very cold water, for instance, because at the point you immerse yourself in very cold water, you know, there's a whole kind of charge and exhilaration and that is momentary, but it's kind of letting the natural world provide the mechanism. So magic has this idea of this endogenous or exogenous forms of trance, or they call it inhibitory and ecstatic. So meditation would be inhibitory, switch off your mind. Excitatory would be or ecstatic would be dancing until you're exhausted. So this particular one is a very quick form of ecstatic, because you're getting this huge rush of, you know, whatever receptors, you know, what receptors are triggered when you jump into cold water. You know, it's certainly a very sort of powerful, quick experience that everybody has. It's a universal experience. No one just jumps into cold water and go, oh, that's all right. You know, it does, you know, it does have a bit of fear there as well, yeah. You know, so, but it's not like a fear that you're going to be eaten by monsters. It's just a general, you know, your body goes into fear, you know, and in theory, you know, your heart has to deal with it. And there's a whole bunch of things that happen in your body. And that's why I was looking at this particular example. It's a very simple example of something circumventing the kind of higher cognitive centers to charge this image in your subconscious. And in a sense, I'm kind of using the world as the subconscious here. So I mean, kind of saying, let nature play the role of the magician, or the magical kind of transformative energy, if you like.
Have you ever seen ghosts, demons, or angels?
No, not certainly not demons or angels. Have I seen ghosts? I've experienced, you know, the kind of sense of presence that goes along, you know, that you describe, but not a kind of material ghost, you know, kind of the sense of presence that comes with, you know, kind of apparitions and things like that. Certainly have experienced, you know, but you know that could be a disembodied form of yourself, if you like, you know. There's a guy called Michael Persing. I don't know whether you've explored him on this podcast, but he was a neuropsychiatrist who died a couple of years ago, but he was interested in kind of a grand unified theory of paranormal phenomena, and he came up with this idea that there was some activity in the kind of temporal lobes that caused people to have experiences. So he kind of equated things like UFOs with kind of low level tectonic magnetic disturbances and things like that. I mean, it's a grand unified theory in it. It was controversial, but what I found very interesting is some of his things about kind of alien induction. He suggested were self-proprioception of yourself in the womb and things like that, hence the kind of imagery of the grey and the fetal type things. And I thought it was a very interesting idea. I'll go back to what I said. I think the imagination's got supernatural powers, to be honest, you know, and rather than ascribing it to like a belief system or the truth, I think like we haven't even scraped the surface of what the imagination is. So it's worth, you know, keeping that in mind, that, you know, if you think about your dreams at night, that irrespective of how mundane they are, they're, in a sense, they're kind of these supernatural processes that act out. They don't have to be supernatural, but, you know, they're very real. They're very real events, you know, and the imagery in the events is far, far stronger than you can ever just do consciously. So something's happening there. A level of like the imagination is almost super powered when it's asleep, you know, create films, you know, it can create these visions that you really can't achieve through meditation and things like that, and that's just by switching off. So I would say that is a facet of the imagination, and it's just we haven't got the ability to tap that much of the imagination.
Can you share with us some of the pictures from your book?
Okay, yeah. So let's have a look. This is probably a good one. So this is the Cave of the Chimaean Sibyl. and it's just outside the city of Naples in Italy on the coast. And it is one of the classical sites of what they call the Oracles of the Dead. They're four sites that are known to have been centers for practicing necromancy, essentially. And this is probably the most theatrical one of them, because from the historical records, they did have a kind of staff there who were orchestrating this journey where people would, from some of the speculation is that there'd be the visitors to this cave would be orchestrated on a journey and given certain hallucinogens, and then they'll go down. If you can see that passage here, they'd go down. I'll show a close up, and they'd go down this passage, and at the end of the passage, this priestess would appear called the Sibyl, and she would cast their prophecies using leaf prophecy. So she'd scatter leaves on the ground, and the person visiting would be asked to interpret what they thought their destiny was from the pattern of leaves on the ground. But she did something interesting. At the side of the cave were two huge doors that the attendants would then open at the moment that the leaves fell on the ground and the wind would scatter them. So the person was left with just a glimpse of their destiny and things like that. And I think it's an amazing place because it shows the kind of theatricality of kind of magic. But you can tell the story of the practice through just visiting. So if you go, I'll just see if there's another picture I've got here. So you saw the entrance to the cave, and this is further down the cave, and at the end is further down the tunnel. And what's really interesting here is that the kind of the way it's been designed to create almost like a Hall of Mirrors effect. So it's quite discombobulating effect. And if you can imagine that they maybe had like something psychoactive as well, and then they've been prepared for this for two or three days, then the experience would be pretty amazing, actually.
In what time period were people practicing magic in this cave?
The cave's construction is dated to the 5th century BC. So, yeah.
The architecture inside this cave is amazing.
It is, yeah. It's terrific, isn't it? Yeah, yeah. The problem with like the Greek and Roman practices is that a lot of them come from historical sources literary sources rather than historical sources. So there'll be writers who write about it, and quite a lot of it is actually, in a strange way, is writers taking a mickey or pastiching it or parodying it, things like that. So the actual loss of the way that we, or archaeologists and historians, put together the actual practice comes from literary sources rather than kind of historical sources. So some of it's quite speculative, really. And you know, some of the ideas that people were at this particular Oracle Dead, that they suggested that people, that some of the attendants were kind of pretending to be ghosts and things like that to facilitate the experience, really. But it's interesting that in actual fact, in most of these practices, the actual prophecies came to people in their dreams.
All the places in your book, including this one, are places that people can go to and actually tour?
Yeah, I mean, some of them are less. For instance, a place called Endor in Israel, which is where the biblical story of the Witch of Endor came from. It does exist, but it's kind of just an old, ruined town. But it does, there is a place. that you can visit. So some of them are, you know, a little bit, let's say, you know, they're kind of, they've lost their historical context to a certain degree, but they all exist physically.
Mm. All right.
And certainly, you know, some of them are, you know, tourist destinations.
Can you show us another one?
Yeah, sure. So it's in North Denmark, and this is a Viking kind of administrative centre that was, you know, kind of a point for mustering their army. And this is a reconstructed longhouse, and if you can see the estuary behind, this is actually Viking longships would sail up here. But these mounds in front are the really most interesting part of it, because here they found a grave of a Norse or Viking seeress, and they were called Volva. And of all the graves, hers is the most rich in grave goods, which suggested she was a very important person to the society. Now, the chieftain who oversaw this place was actually in the process of Christianizing Denmark, but he still kept this witch close at hand. And, you know, one of the ideas is that this was issue they were frightened of, because they didn't, even though they were trying to move towards Christianity, they still had one eye over the shoulder for their pagan past. And her grave goods are fascinating. They found a staff, and they found henbane seeds in there, and henbane is a kind of an hallucinogenic herb that is associated with sort of shamanic travel and out-of-body experiences and things like that. So what's particularly interesting about this grave is that it ties in kind of Norse witchcraft with other forms of European witchcraft. And it's an absolute fact. I haven't got time to go into grave details here, but it's a very important find in the study of witchcraft, and in a sense of a kind of positive witchcraft, really. You know, these weren't people who were vilified by this society, not like Salem or the witch trials in the UK and across Europe. These were people, these were witches who were held in quite high regard and fear, and were quite clearly seen as people who had a potency.
I believe Aleister Crowley is a big inspiration for you. Can you tell us about this?
I don't particularly like the person, Aleister Crowley, or wouldn't have. I don't think he'd been someone I wanted to hang around with. So,
why is that?
Because he was a person that was very destructive towards other people, essentially, you know, and he ruined quite a lot of lives, you know, and he had a destructive personality. He was just self-destructive as well. He was obviously, you know, like a heroin addict, and so he's not a person I admire, though it's very hard to ignore his influence on modern magic. And I think sometimes the kind of dark glamour of his stuff and his bad lifestyle and his terrible way he dealt with people kind of overshadows some of the really interesting work he did, you know, and the particular ritual I look at in the book is a set of workings he did in the Algerian desert, and it's a superb synthesis of landscape and magic. So he had tried doing some workings from a book of an Elizabethan set of magical instructions that John Dee and Edward Kelly had tried out, and they were basically invocations of 30 angels. And Crowley tried this out in Mexico, And he sort of got to about number 28, 29 in the, and was blocked, so he didn't progress. But he went on a holiday with his lover at the time, who was a guy called Victor Neuberg, and they went on a walking holiday in Algeria across the desert, or just they were just going to go under the stars and things like that. But on his a few days into this, or a couple of weeks into this, he felt an urge to resume with this operation of Enochian magic that he had tried out in Mexico and been bought. And it was they basically travel through the desert evoking each of these angels at different points. And it's a fascinating piece of work, and it's had far-reaching influence in magic in the 20th century. So in one of the calls, they invoke this demon called Corazon. It's called the demon dispersion, and it's kind of a master of illusions, and their description of this kind of magical battle they had with this demon that possessed Crowley, as it happens, is absolutely brilliant. It's fascinating. It's kind of, it's like something from The Exorcist in a way. But what really interests me is that he managed to fuse these two, this landscape of the desert with this kind of magical system, and create this kind of hybrid sort of form of very, you know, very modern magic, really, and extremely interesting, with a lot of potential, you know. And as I say, the book's about how can you tell the story of geography through magic. His is a great example of how can magic, you know, be a direct kind of battery for synthesizing different systems. So it's fascinating.
You said he was involved in Enochian magic. Is that referring to Enoch?
Well, yeah, it's meant to, you know, it was, Enochian was a language that was supposedly transmitted by or discovered by this guy called Edward Kelly, who was the assistant to Elizabethan magician John Dee. But Edward Kelly was a very shadowy figure, incredibly interesting, but incredibly shadowy. So somewhat of a charlatan, but part of me feels that he might have been a spy, because obviously John Dee was a big, you know, he was a huge part of the court, the Elizabethan court, and I get a feeling that they sent, that Kelly might have been sent in to dupe him and to test his kind of gullibility, and think, and he certainly did test Dee's gullibility, you know. So the Enochian was this kind of system, this language that Kelly reckoned he'd received as a child, and they wrote it down, and it's supposedly the language of Enoch, you know, and these kind of pre-diluvian watchers, or whatever they were, guardians.
All right, you were going to show us an illustration.
Oh yeah, okay. So I had this idea for the book to create these kind of quite fun, if you like, illustrations that are based on kind of sort of retro aesthetics. Got a very good illustrator called Nick Taylor, who's very able in this area to realize these various different chapters. So each of the chapter has this kind of key image that is a kind of almost like an astral journey into the chapter, and within these images, there's a bunch of elements that then I abstract out and use for creative visualization techniques and things like that. So this is a kind of illustration of the Crowley's trip to the Algerian desert. So there's all, so in the center here you can see the Kabbalistic tree of life. At the top, you can see the beast, seven-headed beast, being ridden by Babylon. In the right-hand corner, this is a depiction of the actual ritual, where and Victor Neuberg is in the circle transcribing the words of this demon who's in the triangle that possessed Crowley. So I kind of tell the story in these images, and I wanted to do it in a kind of quite comic book kind of way, in a, rather than doing sort of like horrible airbrush occult art. I wanted to do something in a colourful way, partly because I want people to be able to like have this kind of astral trip.
What's happening in the picture in the center?
He's doing something unpleasant to Victor Neuberg. Basically, they practice sex magic in there. So this is Crowley's big. This was a big part in Crowley's life. So Crowley was a kind of closet homosexual. Mm. So, well, it was illegal. So there's good reason for him to be, but he came from a very, very Christian background, Plymouth Brethren. So it's an important question, really, that I was trying to avoid.
You know, that's what it looks like. Yeah. I was hoping you were saying that he, I was hoping you were saying it wasn't something like that.
He was blessing him. This is a inverted tower in a garden in a place called Sintra in Portugal. And Sintra is like an occult Disneyland, really. It's an incredibly strange Baroque place full of really, really garish buildings and palaces. But it's got this particular garden called Quinta de Regularia. And it was designed as a kind of heavily occult, symbol laden garden that covers all manner of kind of occult symbols. So and it's very confusing, kind of. So there's alchemical symbols, there's a chapel, but the chapel's got the eye in the pyramid, the Illuminati kind of symbol there. You've got gates with pentagrams on them, inverted pentagrams. But this is my favorite part of the garden. It's an inverted tower. So you walk in this kind of spiral staircase down this inverted tower. And I think it's got 139 steps and 22 of these kind of crevices, which even the official brochure for the site suggests is an initiatory journey based on the tarot, so the 22 cards in the major arcana. And at the bottom, you can see what is a rose cross, which is a kind of Rosicrucian symbol. So it suggests that, you know, that Rosicrucian interest here and interest in tarot, and whether there were actually ceremonies carried out here by the people the person who own the garden, and whether there were, you know, a definite occult ceremony is kind of held secret, you know. But it's to actually go down there. I mean, I've seen photographs of it, but it's one of those places that the photographs don't really do it justice, in fact, of how initiatory it is, really. So I'm wondering whether at some point they might have had statues of each of the figures of the major arcana in each of these little niches. Who knows? But once you get to the bottom, you're kind of underground by then, and then there's a grotto that leads out, an underground grotto for these kind of amazing porous rocks that are kind of quite hallucinatory anyway. And you can imagine if you've gone down there and you've had this ceremony and you go through this place, you start to see things in there. So one of the routes takes you right underneath the garden, you come out the other side at the bottom and things like that. And I just think, as I said, it is like an occult Disneyland, this place, and it's full of these kind of amazing symbols, and it's, you know, you can visit it. I would, you know, if you've got any any people interested in one particular trip in the book, I would recommend going to Sintra, because you'll have an amazing time there. Not just this place, but there's a palace there that is just bizarre, really. And there's another palace, Montserrat, which this guy called William Beckford stayed in. William Beckford wrote a book called Vathek, which was a major influence on Lovecraft. So he's an important Gothic horror writer. But yeah, so Sintra, I recommend if any of your viewers want to go anywhere in the book, I was for a kind of an occult Disney, I'd go here.
Well, it's definitely an architectural marvel. Do you know how they built it? Was it like a cave and they just carved it out?
I don't think it's a cave. I think they basically drilled into the ground, really. I don't think they made use of a natural cave. I think it was designed. I mean, they had a very celebrated landscape designer who was charged with it. I think it was. I don't think they made use of a natural cave. I think they actually landscaped this.
Do you write in your book about Atlantis?
I do. Yeah. I mean, it's quite a thorny topic to tackle, Atlantis, but I thought I should tackle it. And obviously, in the 19th century, we had the Theosophists and people. Or like Blavatsky, Madame Blavatsky, who kind of had these kind of astral travels to Atlantis, and then came up with this idea of this kind of superior race. And obviously, a lot of these ideas were adopted by the Nazis, and Nazi archaeologists went in search of it. So it is kind of tainted by it's got a dark history, Atlantis. But I try to tackle it in a slightly different way. I looked at for the actual itinerary. Now, my feeling on Atlantis wasn't a physical place. There wasn't there wasn't this mystical kind of massively progressive society. But it does have an historical basis in the works of Plato, And I actually went to Santorini, which is old Thera, where Plato based his work about Atlantis on this island, and it kind of does bear it. It does. There's some historical truth to the fact that there was an advanced civilization on Thera, and it was subsumed by a volcano. The island's really interesting. It's got this pattern, this concentric ring pattern that is synonymous with kind of earthquakes, but it's also it bears out how Plato describes it. But Plato was using kind of Atlantis as an allegory of hubris and kind of greed and things like that, and whilst his Atlantean race were progressive, they were also greedy. And so he writes it as an allegory. And I think you see this in all tellings of Atlantis. So in the itinerary, I travel across, I actually look at the Celtic, various eruptions of Celtic Atlantis. So you've got places in, if you think about England, Britain and France were one landmass, and you can see a migration of a kind of mythology, a Celtic Atlantis from France to Cornwall, up to Wales, to Ireland. I was interested in the way the story shifted, things like that. But no matter where you go, there's a sunken forest in mid Wales. There's a bay in France. In all the tellings of Atlantis, there's always a moral kind of comeuppance there, you know. So Atlantis is, you know, kind of analogous with Sodom and Gomorrah. There's some kind of moral turpitude that's caused this great cataclysm. So I do write about Atlantis, and but I try and, you know, I'm going through my, you know, my honest, that's my feeling about it. So I'll just show you, but this is a very interesting place called Breen Down in, and I think this is what Atlantis should look like. So this is a natural promenade on the coast of Somerset in the UK, and this is a kind of Napoleonic, was it pre-Napoleonic War fort, and it looks over to sea, and it kind of looks also that it could be a monastery or something like that, but it's where the occultist and writer Dion Fortune wrote a book, imagined her book to be, and she imagined this reincarnation of an Atlantean sea priestess, and the book's actually called Sea Priestess, and she needs the help of this guy to re-experience her past lives in Atlantis, and she sets this story at this kind of area, and this fort becomes a kind of Atlantean temple and things like that. And it's amazing because she's used like a modern landscape and a you know, a very real landscape to conjure up a vision of Atlantis. So it's a great book, Sea Priestess. You know, Dion Fortune, you know, she's a very interesting writer, and she had some great ideas, and again, it's like Crowley, it's an interesting example of how someone's used one landscape to fuse a magical tradition and things like that. So I really like this vision of Atlantis, because it's kind of technological, but it looks like it's a temple as well, and things like that.
Would you consider your book to be more of a travel guide or a book about the history of magic?
It's a book about the history of magic, but it's unique in the sense that I don't think there's a book out there that tells a cogent history of magic exclusively through geography. And you don't tell the whole story of magic, but what I did find out, what I did discover in writing this book, is that you can tell a cogent and a logical history of magic through traversing its geographies. So, for instance, in necromancy, you can see how necromancy became a blend of like Arabian magic, classical systems, biblical warnings to create the kind of our traditional idea of a medieval grimoire in a kind of quite heretical, and you can actually just, you can trace the drift of it, and you can do that with the kind of Atlantean myths and things like that. So I'm using the conceit of a travel guide here to tell a story. They're not disconnected dots on a page, like, oh, this is an interesting place, this is an interesting place. They're, every place has got a meaning for the whole bigger story that I'm trying to tell. And I think that's the important thing about the book, is that whilst you can visit these places, you can tell the story of magic by following the contours of the book, really.
If someone wants to learn more about your book, should they go to Amazon or your website?
Amazon's probably the place to go to get the book. I'm on Instagram. There's a Astral Geographic Instagram account and an English Heretic one that's gradually, the English Heretic one's been going a while, just set up an account. There will be a website when the book comes out, and those are probably the best places to go at the moment. There's a few talks coming up online, and it's a place called the Victor Whitten Gallery in London. They do online talks as well, so I'll be talking about one of the particular chapters in there. So things are ramping up a bit. So I think the book is the best place to start, really. So Amazon, yeah, it's available on Amazon, Barnes and Noble in the States.
If someone wanted to ask you questions about the book, Are you available for that? And if so, how can they reach you?
You're probably best just get in touch on Instagram. So I've got, I mean, I can send you the links to them, English Heretic or Astral.Geographic. I mean, I'm quite happy to, if people join in, follow me on there, then yeah, absolutely ask questions on there. That's the only social media I do. I have a personal email account, and obviously I'm happy to talk to people on email. Yeah, no problem at all. There's an English Heretic website, my older website from my previous book, that I think has still got an email list. There's a mailing list on there. So there's plenty of places you can get in contact with me. I'm quite accessible, really. Yeah. And always interested in chatting offline and answering questions. You know, I pride myself on I've got a very interesting and informed group of followers who are always I value their intelligence. So yeah.
Well, before we finish up, can you leave us with one last positive message?
One last positive message. Oh, that's a really good question. I think if we look at I'm interested in it in, so we look at something like witchcraft. I look at the kind of way that witchcraft evolved into something that was then attacked by kind of Christianity. But in the 20th century, there's a place called Zugarramurdi in Spain that had like some of the worst witch trials. But there's now a museum there, and it's telling a different story, and it's a story that recognizes the victims but looks at kind of magic as a form of witchcraft as a form of natural magic and looks at what they were doing in a positive light. And again, with the kind of Norse stuff I was seeing, there's a whole kind of tradition of a kind of that the problem is that the kind of the witch trials have painted a particular picture in our psyche, which is far removed from the actual practice. So a lot of I think in virtually every chapter there's a positive message, really. And I think the book is trying to be progressive as well, you know. So I do critique things like the politics of Atlantis and what happened there. And what I was careful not to do was not to just to, you know, go into kind of negative. So I look at kind of different traditions, and I look at ancestor worship. In I think the last trip I do in the book is to Kenya in Africa, and I look at a village that's a sacred village that has been preserved for ancestor worship, and I think that's a really powerful place that shows that, you know, the kind of how magic is part of a community. It was an accident they ended up there, but I think it's very, very, it's a very sensible way to end, because I was spent my formative years in Kenya. So, and my mum and dad have told me a bit about the kind of, you know, the practice of witchcraft out there. You know, it's very different from what we perceive. It's part of society. You know, they do rituals for rain because they need rain, you know, so it's a very important part of society, sub-Saharan societies and things like that.
Andy, thank you for your message, and thank you for being my guest today.
Thank you. No, pleasure. Absolute pleasure. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for watching the Jeff Mara podcast. I really appreciate you. Another way to show support is through YouTube memberships. And if you do, there are loyalty badges and other perks depending on your level of membership. All you need to do is click the join button underneath the video to find out more. Thank you for your support.